Allah, God, the beneficent, the merciful, I bear witness that there is but one God, and I bear witness that Muhammad is his messenger. I greet all of you, my sisters and brothers, with the greeting words of peace. We say it in the Arabic language. As-salamu alaykum. For those unfamiliar with these words, they of course mean in English, peace be unto you. We want to welcome you back to our weekly town hall meeting. And, of course, we gather together to secure justice for the family, for the community, and for the people in the murder of our brother, Oscar Grant III, and justice wherever injustice is found. For it was our brother, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who declared that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And we should know that while Dr. King's name is celebrated today, in that you'll find streets named for him, schools named for him, hospitals named for him, we should know very clearly that while the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was engaged in his work, that he was vehemently opposed. In this modern era, sit here, hosted by our wonderful pastor, the Reverend Gordon Humphreys. Can we give him a big round of applause? Over the months of our stay here, and while we are in this humble facility that celebrates the life of Jesus, we should know that while Jesus was among the people, his life was not celebrated. He was opposed. Tooth and nail. He was opposed by the religious leaders. He was opposed by the political leaders. He was opposed by those who did not want to change the way that things have been done. Over the last week, there's been many events that we need to report to you so that the community and leadership and activists are as informed about what's happening as we possibly can. Now, one of the things that we're striving to do, you should know, with the town hall is start early so that when the email that goes out says 4 o'clock, we're going to push as close to that 4 o'clock hour for the beginning as we can. Because, as you know, time waits for no one. And time must be properly used. And it's those that effectively move in harmony with time that find themselves in the right place, doing the right thing, and backed by the rightness of their effort. And so, moving forward toward next Saturday, we don't want that our 4 o'clock meeting become a 5 o'clock meeting, because you see the trickle-in effect when we are trained into the habit of being late. There's an old expression called CP time, which was an expression used to describe that slaves really didn't want to go to work. So slaves made themselves conveniently unavailable. It was produced by 400 years of a slave-slave master relationship that produced in the slaves a slave mentality. And included in that mindset was the approach that when it comes time for work to be done, that I'll be the last one there, that I'll be the late one there, that I'll be the one that's seeking to avoid or to evade the heaviness of the work that must be done, hoping that somebody else will get the majority of time, hoping that someone else will spend most of the field time. It's a mentality that's developed among many working people. But in this instance, we're not here to receive any paycheck. We're not here because we're looking for a grant. We're here because of the murder of Oscar Grant. And so our time and the value of it is what it is because of our love for justice, our hatred for injustice, and our desire to see a more permanent change affect the communities where we live. And so we were blessed over this past week to gather with busloads from all over Northern California for Caravan for Justice 3. And those that were there represented the Bay Area very well. Give yourselves a big round of applause. to the community council that went out actively to secure support from those that have participated in the town hall and in other locations that traveled. Special note, of course, to Sister Dana Blanchard and the students that came up from LeConte Middle School in Berkeley to learn what real democracy looks like. And so, as we know, the democratic process, unfortunately, has not worked in our favor, meaning our, those that have suffered, those that are black, those that are brown. The Native Americans never have received justice, and it has to be an argument even to consider it. And those that are poor have not been treated rightly by those with authority and in government. Now, I want that in a few moments, our sister, Dr. Tosco, share with us a report from the courtroom. But I just want to take a moment to point out the significance of our demands for justice. As stated repeatedly from this church, as in many churches across the country, the Bible declares that justice stands afar off and equity cannot enter because truth is laying in the street. Our role with Caravan for Justice is to take truth off the street and take it to the state's capital. And if you'll notice, the state capital is in crisis mode right around now. It is a crisis that is driven, it says, by its budgetary problem. But one thing that we want to be very clear about is, if the decisions made yesterday that produced the problem of today. So the problems that they are being afflicted with were not unpredictable. They just didn't tell you what they saw coming. Can't you see that when the real estate market began its turn, that was a predictable turn? They forced that increase of housing values. They permitted those banks to offer loans to people. Imagine this, to show you how easy it was for them to predict. If you ever bought a house, hold the mic. If you ever bought a house or a car, those responsible for issuing the loan, they're not slow to tell you when they don't want to give you the loan that you cannot afford this car or house. So you walk in the door and you're trying to drive a $25,000 used Mercedes or a brand new Volvo. And you walk in and they tell you, well, we can't give you that car. That car's value at $27,000. You need to find one that you can drive, that you'll enjoy, that comes in at about $21,000. To tell you quick, that you cannot afford the $6,000 difference. Now, given that the auto lot will tell you that, and they will not loan you the money, and they will not give you the $27,000 car while you qualify for a $21,000 loan. Well, how, and the reasoning is they'll say that you can't afford it, based on the formula of your income and your expenses, your savings, they will tell you that you cannot afford it. In fact, the fast dealing salesman will say, well, why don't you go borrow some money from your mom? Get $6,000 in cash on top of the already previously agreed upon down payment, and therefore you give us $9,000-$10,000 in cash and we'll let you drive off in that $27,000 car that you say that you wanted. Well, now, that being said, if a car value changing its some amount of $5,000 to $6,000 can make or break a loan deal, how then can a buyer of a property who didn't qualify for $150,000 for a house last year, got the same job, paid the same rent, have the same level of savings, How does that same borrower, how does the bank say to the same person the next year, oh, you now qualify for $300,000. And here's the loan and the keys to the house of your dream. How did that happen? How did the banks declare that you couldn't afford $150,000 and 1 year later declare that you can afford $300,000? How did that happen? What did they expect would happen as a result of offering a loan that a year before they said you couldn't afford and this year they say you can't afford? They knew that there would be a foreclosure crisis. And haven't you noticed when the foreclosure crisis kicks, you put in your down payment. So they got some money right off the top. And even though you weren't able to stay in that house for the 30-year term of the loan, they got out of your pocket $20,000, $30,000 cash. Is that how it works? Now, you can't stay there. But a few months, you're kicked to the curb, but guess who retains ownership of that property? The very bank that sold you that house claims it back, waits for the market shift, and sells it to somebody else. Well, that's simply to say to all of us that the systems of justice have never been written in your favor. They said that the government would help people that were being foreclosed on. I've yet to meet anybody that was actually helped by the government through their foreclosure. They said, oh, we'll give you credit counseling. Well, we were talking about credit before you stepped in. While we were trying to survive these fast changes. But the reality is that we're in a government that serves the rich and the powerful and has very little of good to say for the poor. And this is why, as they're looking now at the state budget crisis, they're saying now that after taking months to agree to a budget, and after finally agreeing to that budget, that within weeks of the agreement of that budget, that the state government was coming in tens of billions of dollars short. Then, after coming in tens of billions of dollars short, they ran a proposal out there and said, well, let's try to raise some taxes. But they knew that there would be a massive organized effort against raising taxes. Well, quite frankly, if you said to me that if I paid $10 more out of my pocket on a month, and then that would keep my children in school, I would find the $10. Wouldn't you? But the reality is that people don't trust government. Because the history has been, they take the $10, don't build a new school, and go and build a new prison. They take the $20, don't build a new school, and go and build a new prison. They take the $50, don't buy a new school, don't build a new school, and go and build a new prison. In fact, one of the largest industries in the state of California is the prison industrial complex. That's right. They pour more money into feeding the prison system. And the reality is that the voices that would challenge that prison system have gone silent because we feel like challenging the prison system makes us soft on crime. Haven't you heard that because of the financial crisis, they're now declaring that they'll have to release another 19,000 nonviolent offenders from the state prison? A few weeks before that, they were saying because of the budget crisis that they would have to release 57,000 or so inmates from nonviolent offenders from the state prison system. The question becomes, if you've got, what is that, 76,000 people that don't need to be there, why are we paying so much to keep them there at over $40,000 annually for keeping them there. Don't you know with $40,000, how much is Stanford?
About
40,000? You know, so these that are incarcerated could be educated at the highest level. Stanford is one of the highest levels of education in the state. Is that true? And it takes students, though they have to qualify themselves for attending there, but the cost of those students is approximately $40,000 a year. Well, if you gave a poor person $20,000 and an education, might that suffice their needs? That poor person, of which 76,000 are incarcerated, really could be released. They're just holding them there so they can say they kept them there through the time. So Caravan for Justice is to say to the state of California, your priorities have been off. Your previous decisions have led the state to the brink of bankruptcy. California is broke. Now, when you are broke, there's really only one way to resolve that problem. You're going to have to increase your income and decrease your spending. So while we understand there is certainly a need for some cuts, look at Mr. Schwarzenegger. We are not going to increase any income. And we're going to cut everything. We're going to cut the food. We're going to cut the education. We're going to cut the health care. Well, why don't he cut his own salary? Why doesn't he sell his fleet of cars and produce a salary for a state worker? See, if he were really serious, why don't they cut the benefits they've given to the wealthy corporations that don't pay their part in the state tax pool? See, they find a way to cut the wealthy and make the poor to suffer. And so when we make our caravan, we know that Caravan 3 is just part of a system to say that priorities must be changed. And the reason they must be changed are bearing themselves out in every day that Johannes Mezele has been in trial. So we have with us this afternoon one of our sisters who's been our activist reporter right there at the door. I have to say that I've been to several days, and the only days I've not been able to go is because of conflict of schedule in our movement, but we are always present in that courtroom. But our sister, the Reverend Dr. Tosca, not only has been present, she's probably there letting the guards in the door. First one in the building. Sister Tosca, what time did they open the building? They open the building at 8 o'clock a.m. You're there before they open the building? She's there at 6 o'clock in the morning to make sure that we're represented in that courtroom. And there's no promise that we will be represented in there. That courtroom is very small. I don't know whose decision it was to use a room of that size. However, I can tell you this. What I don't like every time I go in, and that is, when I get in, of course, Mr. Mezele and the Grant family have a certain amount of seats allocated. But I can tell you, this is hard to tell who's Mr. Mezele's family. You know why? The Grant family comes in at the appropriate time, and they walk right in the front door where we're waiting to get in. And we can encourage them, greet them, cheer them on their way into court, whether we're able to get in or not, give them our blessing, our well wishes. The Mezele family does not come through the front door. When we get into trial, there's a few people that are already there all the time. Now we know why the Grant family is there and how they got in, because they walk right past us. And when we walk in, it's like we're going back to Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal. They just took civil rights back 100 years in that courtroom. Because once we're in the room, you have the Grant family on the right-hand side, which we're right, so I guess it's good to be on the right-hand side. But you've got the Grant family on the right-hand side, and Johannes Meserle and whoever's behind him on the left-hand side. When you walk in, you'll notice that it's, in essence, 90% white on the left-hand side and 95% black on the right-hand side. This is a Plessy versus Ferguson moment. No wonder they won't let cameras in this courtroom. Because it would send a picture to the whole world that Oakland in 2009 is no different from Alabama in 1955 in that courtroom. Now, once we are in the room, a third of the seats have been taken already. The Grant family, of course, must have its position. Mr. Meserle and his loved ones, if anybody loves him, must have their position. I said if anybody loves him. Now, what's disturbing is they lock in, look like a whole row for press people who, to this point, have proven to report quite inaccurately. They're looking for a soundbite here and a statement there, but they seem to miss so much. They seem to miss the officer, Domenici, who was so frightened that night. And Dr. Tosco is going to give us more, of course, because she's witnessed it all. But here, they didn't really report well, that the DA had to wrangle with her. She would not bear witness to clear truth. Every witness that came to that stand talked about the kind of language that Peroni gave when he came onto the bar area. He cussed everybody out. He even cussed the train out. He cussed the train out. He told them to get off the effing train. The man cussed the train. And when the young people didn't respond to him well, which I clearly understand, because you'll only get so much action from me cussing. If I'm paying attention to you while you're cussing at me, I must really want to save you. Now, Oscar Grant and his friends were not obligated to save Peroni from his own foolishness. So when he approached them, cussing at them, I would ignore him too. I can't be who you're talking to. So if I'm on the BART train and somebody says, hey, N-word, get off the train. I'm not getting off the train. You will have to snatch me off. And if I get off, you might do best to run, because I'm getting off to handle some business. This is going to be a fight. So if I get off under that kind of directive, I'm getting off to fight. But now every witness declared that Officer Peroni came in fussing and cussing at everybody. Except for Ms. Dominici. His partner. Did you hear Officer Peroni cuss at the young man? No, I heard him tell me I'm not a real cop. Did I hear it? Did you hear, did Officer Peroni use foul language? No, they told me I ain't done SH word. Did you hear Officer Peroni, even Peroni came in cussing. He didn't deny that he'd come in cussing. The man is a cusser, obviously. So when you heard if you watched him walk in the room, you knew right off the top that he thinks too much of himself. Soon as he walked in, I had never seen him before other than in the video footage. You don't get good, clear shot of him. He walked in, arrogance was exuding from every fiber of his body. Did you notice that? And when the judge asked him, Brother Salim was in school with me some years ago. He's a witness, and there's others that are here. We had some students that when we would say them to them to get obedience to an instruction, they would answer in a tone of voice that you know that yes, sir, didn't really mean yes, sir. And then shut up talking to me. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Sit down. Yes, sir. You remember those days, right?
Yes, sir.
Say it again. Moroni comes in and he starts yes, sir-ing people. Did you cuss out? Yes, sir. What did you say? I said, get off the up the effing train, sir. And he had this twang in his voice. He thought it was a joke. Then at a certain point, excuse me, Your Honor, sir, I'm going to have to cuss here. Well, the point here is the man did not take the murder of Brother Oscar seriously. And he and Ms. Domenici were very clear about the fact that the young men and others on the platform, in their mind, did not respect their authority. Now, to be clear, law enforcement officers do have authority. I have authority. I'm a father. I have authority. I'm a husband. I have authority. I'm a teacher. I have authority. I'm a student in the ministry. But that does not mean that because you do a thing that I don't like, that it's in my right to abuse you with words or deeds. You would call that the abuse of authority. And in the case of a law enforcement officer, it comes under the color or the badge of law. Now, when you do that, you should know as a law enforcement officer that my abuse of authority here is not personal. I represent the state. So now, when I abuse you, I am not just personally a wicked, arrogant, racist police officer. I'm representing the state. So now my wickedness becomes state wickedness. My arrogance becomes state arrogance. My evil becomes state evil. So on the night of January the 7th, when Mayor Dellums went out into the street and got cussed at by young people that were angry about the city's inaction, I told him, Mr. Mayor, they didn't curse you, they cursed the system. Don't take it personally, because those that are cussing at you only know government by the hand of the police. So to them, that bullet, and the mayor said it in his press conference, by the way, on the next day, the bullets that were fired were state-sponsored bullets. The evil that was practiced then becomes state-sponsored evil. The murder of Oscar Grant then becomes a state-backed murder until the state turns its back and convicts the murderer. That's why BARC should immediately take positions, not only with Johannes Messing. They didn't fire him. But now, with every BART officer that have come to testify, that have taken the position, if at first you don't succeed, lie, lie again. I didn't hear no cussing. The only thing I heard was this wild cry going off on me. So I want to give our sister, Dr. Tosco, an opportunity to share with us more of the details that came out in the court proceeding. But one thing that is clear, and Attorney Burris has gotten it right on point, that is that Anthony Peroni was the greatest instigator of violent events on the BART platform that night, and he's on paid vacation.
Months and months.
So now we come here, not for pay, but for free. Our pay comes from our God for standing for what is right and for doing what is required in order to render justice in the murder of Brother Oscar Grant. So I want us to hear more about the case proceedings. So I want you to join me in receiving our sister 6 a.m. every morning. She lets the bailiff in. So please receive our great warrior, Sister Reverend Dr.